to first thank Andreas for having invited me and Jacqueline for her kind introduction. This is sort of false advertising because it's not only, it's much less specific about psychiatry, although there's a lot of that in here, but I'm surrounded by experts. I am not an expert. I did indeed write a book on Joan of Arc. However, what I'm going to say today has nothing to do with my book. Voices, the anthropologists tell us, are material embodiments of social ideology and experience. We can further agree that vocal practice consists in bodily acts linked to subjectivity and to structures of power within the social sphere. Indeed, the materiality of the voice, its sonic performance, engages social meaning, gender, class, geographic origins, race, and so on. And while voice can suggest identity, some aspects of the voice do not necessarily engage individuality. A voice may be constitutive of age, social status, states of being, aspects that align with the social structure, but do not grant or suggest identity with any certainty. Bakhtin's notion of heteroglossia may be added to these elements as the basic condition governing the operation of meaning in any utterance. Heteroglossia, you'll remember on his account, ensures that what is said in one time and place will be different when uttered in a different time and place. Context trumps text, in other words. At the same time, however, utterances comprise a network of forces impossible to retrieve or resolve. And there's also interruption. Voices compete with one another in a polyphonic world and are frequently resistant to the dominant discourse. The levels of meaning and contextual utterances, in other words, are very noisy indeed. To the extent that heteroglossia for Bakhtin produces a network of both irretrievable and irresolvable forces, one can liken it to Althusser's notion of ideology or to Freud's unconscious. For Althusser, ideology is everywhere. Nothing can occur outside it. As such, it is hidden by its very ubiquity, eternal and transhistorical, much like, to repeat, the Freudian unconscious. Althusser adds that while subjects freely accept ideology, they then have to organize their behavior accordingly. So too utterances. They function within a grammatical structure and meaning system, both consciously and unconsciously, and one can say are shaped by the dominant ideology. While it was religion, writes Althusser, which was the prevailing ideology until fairly recently, now ideology stems from the capitalist state. And of course, Althusser is not interested in non-capitalist states. In the Europe of the 15th century, for example, you are interpolated by the ideology that is the church. But since the 19th century and the advent of capitalism, it is the ideology of the state and its hegemony that interpolates the subject. For Althusser, it is ideology's very obviousness, as I said, that keeps it hidden. Statements such as, of course, and as we know. Within ideology, the individual is always already a subject. The subject is indeed created by ideology, and at the same time, there's no ideology without concrete subjects. So it's a kind of vicious circle. Recall Althusser's famous example. Subjects almost always recognize when they are hailed. The "hey, you there" of a policeman is acknowledged by the individual, interpolated as a concrete subject by ideology. In recognizing him or herself in the hailing, the subject admits to the state's power and to hegemony. The subject is positioned accordingly and recognizes this. But what do we do with a subject who is in conversation with inner voices that no one else can hear? Enter Joan of Arc, among, of course, many other such subjects. As one of the last figures of the Middle Ages and simultaneously as one of the first modern figures, Joan is by definition already liminal, at least historically. She's further so because she engages both the ideology of the late medieval church and the politics of nationalism. As such, by the way, she poses a problem for the producers of school textbooks in France. She belongs to the state and to the history of France on the one hand, and must thus be present in any pedagogic of a narrative of France. But on the other hand, her motivation is religious, thus disallowed from public school teachings. Further complicating matters is that Joan's voices are oddly and consistently political. Her divine interventions are political. That is, they give her instructions on how to win France back militarily from the British and the Burgundians, and how to restore power to the king. And there are other difficulties with Joan and her voices. For Joan's is a heterologic conversation with interlocutors of extreme alterity, angels and saints. The result, however, is not glossolalia, what we heard about earlier today, that is, speaking in an unknown language or in tongues, what Michel de Certeau calls trompe l'oreille. It is rather to repeat an instance of radical heterology. Certeau likens heterology to Freud's return of the repressed, the representation of the other in any hegemonic discourse. Such alterity, he adds, can be psychic or somatic, an otherness then of the mind or of the body. But Certeau's specific interest is in the ventriloquization of the possessed subject in demonology and the ensuing glossolalia. He will therefore not help us in this particular instance, though his thought undergirds a great deal of my argument here. Joan's voices speak to her in a normal way, clearly, grammatically, lucidly, as Joan herself speaks at her trial. She never speaks in tongues or in mystical discourse, nor, she declares, do her voices. I've said thus far that the voice is understood as a sonic materiality and as a material embodiment of social ideology and experience. But it is at best complicated to inscribe Joan in this set of principles, though it has been done, as we'll see. Indeed, to the extent that disciplinary discourse serves to banish alternate thought, Joan has been neutralized in this sense by several disciplinary ideologies. To begin with, of course, in her day, the church, with its English sympathizing theologians who ran the trial. Then the nationalist movement and military goals that were England during the latter part of the Hundred Years' War. One, Henry VI, which is partially attributed to Shakespeare, is perhaps the most obvious example of the English perspective some 160 years after Joan's death. The play portrays her as a witch who says that she's pregnant so that she can't be burned at the stake. We may add to these the monarchic principle of divine right of kings, to which Joan certainly adhered. And finally, we could include the political power structures that comprised England and what was left of France during the Hundred Years' War. Each of these had a vested interest, political, religious, social, nationalistic, commercial, monarchic, in explaining the curious experience of the maid and her voices. All of these, of course, have to do with the larger structures of power on all levels. Joan was 12 and in her father's garden when she first heard a voice. It was that of the Archangel Michael telling her that the saints Margaret of Antioch and Catherine of Alexandria would soon speak to her as well, and that she should pay attention to them. She was, in other words, hailed by Saint Michael, a point to which I'll return. Joan was raised by a devout Catholic mother who gave her religious instruction. She also attended Mass and confession regularly and knew a few prayers by heart. She was reported to be extremely pious. Although she was illiterate and could not even sign her name, we know she would have heard the numerous traveling singers of tales who wandered the countryside by telling the stories of saints, the equivalent today of various blockbuster movies and serials like The Wire or Mad Men or People magazine. Jacques de Voragine's 13th century work, The Golden Legend, a collection of saints' lives, gives an idea of how this oral tradition, which was pervasive, like the Homeric one among others, was vested in formulaic, repetitive patterns that served to aid the singer's memory. The female saints of early Christianity, as told in Voragine's written version of the saints' lives, were almost always from Roman families that were wealthy, gave up all their worldly possessions and their families for their new Christian beliefs, were virgins, and went to extraordinary lengths to remain so, shaving their heads, for example, or dressing as men, and ended up as martyrs for the faith. Both Saint Margaret and Saint Catherine fit neatly into this paradigm, Both significantly were warrior saints, as is the Archangel Michael, protector and patron saint of France. Ironically enough, or perhaps unsurprisingly, Joan herself was to repeat Voragine's pattern. Her father was a wealthy farmer. It's not true that they were poor. She gave up everything, including her family, to obey her voices and lead the French army. She swore to remain a virgin, went to great lengths to remain so, and dressed like a man. And of course, she ended up a martyr to her faith, although that was not recognized at the time. Her choice of the three voices, in other words, is in keeping with what Joan knew and believed. There was also a statue of St. Margaret of Antioch in her local church, no doubt a further inspiration. The ideology, Althusser would say, had done its work. The first time Joan hears the voice of St. Michael, he calls her by her name. Perceval de Bougainvilliers, knight and counselor to the king, and Joan's contemporary recounts the events this way. This is one of the actual descriptions. Suddenly, a luminous cloud, the Latin is nubes prelucida, appeared before her eyes, and out of a cloud came a voice saying, Jeanne, you are destined to lead a different kind of life and to accomplish miraculous things, for you are she who has been chosen by the King of Heaven to restore the kingdom of France and to aid and protect King Charles, who has been driven from his domains. You see the political tenor of the voice. You shall put on masculine clothes, you shall bear arms and become the head of the army, all things shall be guided by your counsel, end quote. I'm still quoting Bougainvilliers here. He says, after these words had been spoken, the cloud vanished and the girl, astounded by such a marvel, at first could not give credence to it. She kept her own counsel. To none, he says, save to her priest, did she speak. And in this perplexity, she continued for the space of 5 years. Now, there's a glaring error here, quite apart from the curious narrative. Joan never told her priest about her voices. This omission took on great importance during her trial of condemnation. Because according to the Lateran Council of 1215, any vision, voice, or other mystical event had to be confessed and reported to the priest or to a higher clerical figure so that the church representative could interpret the occurrence. This is paradoxically an essentially anti-theological move on the part of the church. In the words of one critic, the papacy, in order to shore up its sovereignty, produces, quote, a model of human access to truth and divinity that is fragmented and timorous. A mystical event, in other words, can only be hermeneutically assessed by the clergy and not by the one who actually experiences the event. In this sense, language is seen as unable to represent divine truth as it had been seen to do before. Moreover, in making this rule, the church has shifted language from the sacred to the political. Through this new notion of confession, furthermore, the private is placed within the institutional. Thus, Joan's silence about her voices, her refusal to discuss them at confession or with any ecclesial figure, was to form one of the final judgments against her. In her trial, she repeatedly says that she does not have permission from the voices to reveal their instructions. She believes in the triumphant, not in the church militant, though she would not have known the difference. But Lateran IV has the explicit goal of strengthening the church militant, and the refusal to recognize the clergy as the sole interpreter of any odd or mystical happening is reason enough to be declared a heretic. So the theologians who were judges at the trial of Joan repeatedly fault her for thinking that she herself knows what the voices are saying and what they mean, that she alone can understand them. And indeed, it's important to recognize here that the judges at Joan's trial never question the reality of the voices she heard. They're only interested in whether those voices come from God or the devil. And they have Lateran IV to support the fact that only they, the clergy, can make such a finding. When the judges ask her how she knew she was hearing Saint Michael and not the devil, Joan innocently replied that she eut cette volonté de le croire, had the will to believe it. But that, as the judges made clear, was not a determination for her to make. And, as I'm suggesting throughout this little chat, in a sense, it never has been hers to make, even if the Inquisition is a thing of the past. There are, after all, other forms of Inquisition, as we will see. I said earlier, echoing Althusser, that Joan was hailed. Instead of the policeman's, "Hey, you there," however, she's interpolated by a divine messenger of God. Saint Michael's voice begins with her name. Jeanne, you are destined. I want to note that this is a biblical trope in both Hebrew scripture and the Second Testament. Moses, Abraham, and Samuel, to name a few, are all hailed by the voice of God, their name opening the vocal pronouncement in each instance, followed by the hearer's frequently ubiquitous response, "Here I am." In the Second Testament, Saul, on the road to Damascus, of course, famously hears God's voice, which begins with "Saul, Saul." And Saul, soon to be Paul, sees a blinding light before he hears the voice. So you remember the shining cloud in the voice of St. Michael. These are biblical passages that Joan would know well from her regular attendance at Mass and her mother's religious teachings. So it's unsurprising, perhaps, that St. Michael's voice begins with her name, that his voice emanates from a luminous cloud, that Joan initially did not know who was speaking to her, that she was afraid. All of these, which Vladimir Propp calls functions in a plot, are at work in the biblical narratives. Divine voices are at work too in the classical epics, though the sound of a voice from a divinity into the human realm is less shocking in those texts because, as you know, the gods are always chattering with each other and humans all the time. In book 4 of the Aeneid, for example, Jupiter sends Mercury as his messenger to tell Aeneas to stop enjoying himself in Carthage with the beautiful Dido and to get on with the founding of Lavinium. Mercury's utterance is a hailing without a first name. "You," he says to Aeneas, "alas, forgetful of your own kingdom and your responsibilities." Aeneas has a response that is frequent upon hearing a divine voice. I quote, "But indeed Aeneas was struck dumb by the vision." Remember, we heard about that earlier. "Out of his mind, his hair bristled with fear, and his voice stuck in his throat." As is often the case in these tales, whether biblical, classical, or historical, the intervention of a divine voice initially robs the interlocutor of his own vocal ability. It's also a trope in the classical texts, whether Homer or Virgil, that the divine messenger whose voice will be heard is preceded by a golden cloud or is in a golden cloud. The motif of a luminous cloud or of a bright light is to be found in a variety of religious traditions. We can just mention here the pagan Jewish Christian as announcing a divine intervention by way of a voice. Such a motif is found in Joan of Arc's own experience, as we've seen. Just as vestigial Celtic traditions remained in her village of Domremy, so the representation of divine vocal intervention draws on at least two sources, the biblical and the classical. Joan's voices are announced by a bright light, and as she testified at her trial, usually heard in the church bells. So let me make a few more comments about Joan's voices before we consider how they were interpreted, first by the judges and theologians at her trial, and then by early French psychiatrists. Joan said at her trial that her voices spoke to her in French, which is odd given that French was not Joan's first language. It was rather her patois of Languedoc, which would have been essentially incomprehensible to a French-speaking person. Joan had to learn fluent French, or fairly fluent French, when she spoke to the king, and later when she led the French army, and her trial was held in French. She further said that although at first, when she began to hear the voices, she was terrified and dumbstruck, like Aeneas, she gradually came to believe in her voices and had actual conversations with them, so there was give and take. She also argued with them, sometimes bitterly, which contradicts the frequent view used both at her trial, as well as in much later assessments of her, that her voices said only what she wanted them to say. As Victoria Sackville-West points out in her wonderful book on Joan, the voices did not always please her, or agree with her. So I want to make two points here, two more points. First, Joan speaks only of voices and never of visions until well into her trial. Her judges were constantly insisting on knowing what her three saints looked like, what they were wearing, how long their hair was. The judges were, by the way, oddly obsessed with the saints' hairdos. When Joan finally starts describing the voices as visions and not just audio experiences, it seems fairly clear that it's for the purpose of placating her increasingly insistent and hostile accusers. Her saints were consistently described by her as auditory and not a visual experience until she was forced into saying that they were ocular as well. Secondly, Joan does not speak in tongues, as I mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, nor does she resort to a mystical discourse. What she does do quite often is to tell the judges that she will not answer a given question, questions always having to do with what the voices said. With probing, she usually responds with passé outre, move past this, or she lapses into silence. And silence poses an interesting problem for the 1927 silent movie by Dreyer on the Passion of Joan of Arc. How do you represent silence in a silent film? Whereas the mystical can be described following Certeau as that which eludes direct knowledge, Joan does not have a secret to protect. She tells the court that she's simply following her voice's instructions and that she is more afraid of her voices and of disobeying them than she is of her judges at the trial. So now we turn to the aliéniste, or the early psychiatrists of the 19th century in France. They were so called because they took care of those, of course, who were seen as alienated from society or from themselves and so forth. Interestingly, the major concern of 19th century psychology in France is to, or one of the major concerns, is to distinguish between reason and madness, and in so doing to attempt to establish the science of mental disease. But the question that comes up consistently in the texts of the period is how it can be, why it is, that madness can appear as reasoned. Dr. Ulysse Trélat, for example, writes La Folie Lucide in 1861 and says that the mad, quote, often do not seem mad because they express themselves with so much lucidity, end quote. How does one then discern between the mad and the sane, given that the sane are themselves often prone to moments of madness and the mad frequently seem completely reasonable? In the budding field of 19th century French psychology, two strains are evident. The mad should be treated rather than imprisoned, since, along with humanitarian concerns, they are but one step, degré, beyond the sane. Secondly, and somewhat in support of this first claim, many famous thinkers whom we all revere were in fact mad. Socrates was prey to hallucinations and mad, thus. Tasso was so crazy he had to be hospitalized. Luther had long talks with the devil and was an excellent example of an aliéné. Pascal, which is a fascinating case, who constantly saw a gaping abyss on his left side, was out of his mind. They had to put a chair there all the time so that he wouldn't feel he was falling into the abyss. Edgar Allan Poe was a hereditary degenerate. These are all their terms. Gérard de Nerval, fou. But Rousseau seems to be the worst of all. He suffered, say doctors of the period, from hypochondria, a persecution complex, self-absorption, neurasthenia, fetishism, masochism, exhibitionism, and that's only part of the list. The point of these psychological case studies is not only to show how brilliant minds can also be deranged, and thus to argue for a certain respect, or at least pity, for the mad, nor is it only to prove, as was commonly believed, that genius is itself a form of madness. The idea, too, is to create a science of psychology by using the new discoveries of medicine and science, but also historical material. This latter approach, dubbed retrospective medicine, was first used by Alexandre Bertrand in 1825. He argued that humans should be studied in their abnormal as well as normal states. We must, he writes, interrogate the history of all people. We must dare, with a judicious critical eye, to look to the past and overcome the narrow limits of a circle of ideas that cannot contain all of the truth, and know how to elevate ourselves above even the prejudices of science. Here, psychology is influenced by the great historical revival that invades France in the 19th century. Thierry and Barante, for example, will be followed by the great Michelet, Tocqueville, then Renan, and Taine, among others. It's not surprising that a century with so many revolutions, abdications, and regime changes should become obsessed with the workings of history. Bertrand writes that he hopes that psychology and medicine will finally join in what he calls real historical criticism as well. Patients, he says, should be studied without preconceptions and rather approached by trying to know them, quote, in order to find an explanation, and not for the purpose of superimposing any given historical or other system. It is worth noting the extent to which psychology is expected here to draw from literary and historical work, coupled with the insistence that pure medicine should do the same. Bertrand, as we considers mesmerism and somnambulism in particular from both a historical and medical point of view. What the historical perspective imparts is that cultures give varying meanings to states of what he still calls ecstasy, which is an early word for, well, you'll see. In the time of Joan of Arc, or of the nuns at Loudun, whom Certeau has written so well about, such a state was considered to be the workings of the devil or magic. But in the present, says Bertrand, we can see the same state and attribute it to brain malfunction. Since, he's writing in post-French Revolutionary France, after all, quote, he says, the religious spirit has been extinguished. It's very interesting in connection with Alessandro's paper. Indeed, the emphasis on reason, inherited from the Enlightenment, forced a revised notion of saints and their miracles within the psychiatric field. Such an emphasis produced early in the century a complete revision of the way Joan of Arc, along with people like Saint Teresa of Avila and other mystics who heard voices, were now to be viewed. These mystics, the alienist explained, were suffering from a form of delirium, which was termed hallucination by 1830. Clearly not visited by God or his messengers, mystics were, argued the doctors, simply insane. Leray, for example, writes Fragments Psychologiques in 1834, arguing that Moses and Ezekiel were hallucinants and Saint Teresa cataleptic. As far as much of psychology was concerned then, so much for the church. It had lost its hold on matters concerning visions, voices, and divine intervention in general. So it's the exact opposite of what happened as a result of Lateran IV. Thus, the development of the science of psychology before Freud and before psychoanalysis turns to reason to demonstrate unreason and to clinical observation to argue that madness is never far from rational thought and indeed frequently includes it. Bertrand, Lélu, Baillarger, and most of the other alienists of the 19th century become adherents of a kind of cultural relativism. They argue that differing cultural contexts give varying explanations for what psychology can now recognize as the same phenomena. Lélu writes that the friends of Socrates and Socrates himself could not have seen him for the madman he was because of the, quote, circumstances of place, period, and religion. This made his behavior explicable. That's in Psychologie historique, 1836. Joan of Arc's judges, he continues, were acting in the context of the Inquisition. Demonology and a belief in heretics naturally followed. Thus, psychology understands itself as holding a privileged position, as had the church earlier, since it can, in its view, objectively recognize and classify delusional states by extracting them from differing cultural assumptions and religious convictions, an undertaking that William James was to dub the psychologist's fallacy. 19th century French psychology is filled with problems concerning descriptive vocabulary, terminology, and struggles to diagnose the mad, in terms of the new field. For example, during her trial, Joan of Arc's voices, as I said, were never themselves questioned, but rather the issue was whether they came from God or the devil. At the beginning of the 19th century, however, psychology mostly no longer believes in her voices at all, and the issue is rather how and why the brain malfunctions, and thus one hears them. The taxonomy of Joan herself throughout the century serves as a good indicator of the field's linguistic as well as conceptual development. In 1818, Pinel will describe Joan of Arc as suffering from catalepsy. In the 1820s, Bertrand will use the word ecstasy and somnambulist to diagnose her, though he's already complaining about the vagueness of his terms. In the 1830s, Lélu and Baillarger will call her a hallucinant, and by the end of the century, of course, she's a hysteric. Terms are abolished, modified, or invented, but the description of the illness does not fundamentally change until we might say Charcot. The term psychiatry itself, let us recall, was invented in 1808 by the German Dr. Rell. These changes in psychological vocabulary indicate the manner in which the discipline grows, evolves, and attempts to define itself and its praxis. The linguistic instability, however, is not merely a question of taxonomy and new discoveries. It also points to the uncertainty that marks the psychology and brain science of the period. How does the imagination work to create hallucinations, asked Baillarger? How do we explain such a disruption in the physiological order? In this regard, he concludes, we know nothing, and no doubt the best is to agree to this rather than to look for useless explanations. The 1830s and 40s show the fact that hallucination is of the greatest interest. I've already noted that the important work of Escarole, Leray are there, but Leray published his work on hallucinations in 1834. In 1838, after having written several articles on the subject, Lélu produces a history of hallucinations, including his important treatise on the madness of Socrates. Here, Lélu argues that the philosopher, that pinnacle of reason, was mad because of his demon or genie, and that he suffered from auditory hallucinations. The implication is that if he was mad, reason and madness have to be far from being polar opposites. Audio hallucinations, argues Lélu, are the transferal of a feeling to the sensory apparatus. They are more, you can see where Charcot comes in this later, in this discourse. Audio hallucinations are more interesting and more rare, he says, than visual ones. And he says, and others, that the treatment for audio hallucinations includes leeches behind the ears to lessen the pressure on the brain, straitjacketing, cold baths, enemas, and a journey to the Swiss Alps. Meanwhile, Moreau de Tours, after trying a lot of hashish, produces Du hashish et l'aliénation mentale in 1845, arguing, among other things, that drug-induced hallucinations, like dreams, hold the key to the human psyche, but are not real hallucinations. This is a distinction, by the way, that Baudelaire is very aware of. They're not a mental problem. They're caused by the drug. In 1844, Baillarger had won the Academy's question, quote, hallucinations. This was the Academy's question. Hallucinations, the causes producing them, and the maladies they characterize. His huge book on the subject profits from Lélu's earlier work, and of course from Pinel, Leray, Esquirol, and Bertrand, to name just a few. We're reminded once again that false sensory perception, hallucination, is not diabolical. It is a misfiring of the brain, and frequently a problem found in the carotid arteries. He argues, too, that the mad are different in degree and not in kind, as Wordsworth said of the poet. 1 year later, Brière de Boismont wrote a book that had in it almost all of the vocabulary in psychology at the time. Des hallucinations ou histoires raisonnées des apparitions, des visions, des songes, de l'extase, du magnétisme et du somnambulisme. And in 1861, Brière puts out another work, de l'hallucination historique ou études médico-psychologiques sur les voies et les révélations de Jeanne d'Arc. He also wrote another equally large book with the same title, except it was on Shakespeare. But with this book on Jeanne d'Arc by Boismont, things get, or Brière as he's called, things get more complicated. Since Brière has what we might call a Catholic, as in Roman, agenda. He wants to argue against l'élu Baillargé and Luré and hold that there is a difference between Joan of Arc, Socrates, and Pascal on the one hand, and all the contemporary hallucinants among the mad on the other. The first three, that is, Joan, Socrates, and Pascal, while given to hallucinations, were nevertheless reasonable and, quote, compatible within their time, explains Brière. Patients in his own period, on the other hand, are simply insane. Now, this odd and specifically anti-Lélu argument is motivated by Brière's fear that the religious event, such as hearing voices, is being annihilated by psychological approaches and science in general. So in its attempt to retrieve the religious voice. Thus, he concludes that audio hallucinations are physiological, but they're not pathological or morbid in earlier periods. With this new definition, coupled with a certain cultural relativism, Brière manages to save Joan of Arc from being classified as mad. Ça va, j'ai encore quelques temps, là?
Oui, j'ai encore
5
minutes.
Ah, chouette. Bon, 1845 marks a period of argumentation and discussion in the emergence of psychological treatment of hallucinants and the historical approach that had characterized case studies to that point. The three figures that are consistently and even obsessively evoked in these discussions of hallucinants are once again Socrates, Pascal, and Joan of Arc. But Joan is a woman, as you know, which puts her, according to all the alienists, in a separate category. For the female sex, all the alienists agree, is particularly susceptible to hallucinations of all types. Joan is in this regard merely another example. Nonetheless, the mystical aspect, as I've said, is problematic for them. It's easy for the alienist to explain away Socrates' daemon as the result of a polytheistic culture, a culture upon which many of these writers heap endless scorn with conviction and vigor. But Joan, after all, is hearing from Christian messengers, which poses a problem. And so the alienists, who, like Brière, are devout Catholics, are more restricted in their clinical explanation of Joan's voices. Above all, they don't want to label her as insane and have taken a scientific stance against any belief at the same time in demons or divine intervention. The alienist less tied to the church, on the other hand, can easily erase the whole business, deploying what they see as purely scientific rationales. There, Socrates is indeed mad, and Joan suffers from illusions caused by a malfunction of some sort of the nervous system. Now, in more recent times, the work of Julian James, which some of you may remember, has suggested a rethinking of audio hallucinations, the origin of consciousness in the breakdown of the bicameral mind, which is the name of the book from 1976, argues that humans originally did not have consciousness and heard a voice which seemed to come from the gods, but in fact came from another, as yet unassimilated, part of the mind. It's interesting if you read Freud's early formulation of the superego, which also appears as an outside voice initially. This would explain, says Jane, Socrates, a fictional character such as Achilles, and any other number of ancient figures who hear divine instructions. And for Jane's, he says this explicitly, Joan of Arc is a salient example of a vestigial bicameral mind. So here the so-called mystical experience and the 19th century definition of madness are conflated into the mechanisms of the neurological brain. Let me just add that during the 20th century and more recently, various other explanations for audio and or ocular hallucinations have been proposed. The most common is the diagnosis of schizophrenia. Joan did, after all, first hear her voices when she was approaching puberty, which is the typical age for hearing voices in schizophrenic cases. There are two things wrong with this view. First, in my opinion, we cannot psychoanalyze retrospectively onto a period that bears neither our language nor our categories for ailments, nor finally our own notion of a person or an individual. Secondly, and more importantly, as any contemporary psychiatric text will attest, schizophrenics gradually become more dysfunctional when they are without medication until they cease being able to function at all. Moreover, they lose the ability to narratize, have no sense of time, and are unable to understand a boundary between their bodies and the external world. Joan, on the other hand, plans battle strategies and responds with lucidity and acumen to the judges at her trial, judges who are speaking French to her and whose purpose is to trip her up and confuse her with obscure and technical theological points. I don't have time to give you an example, but there's some wonderful examples. Let me add in passing that more recent journals of neuropsychology and psychiatry have also ventured explanations for what are still called hallucinations. Joan, writes one psychiatrist in 2012, was the victim of a psychogenic mood disorder. Another writes that she simply had ocular migraines, 1987. Same year, hallucination is described as an attack on the temporal lobe, the possible result of convulsions. This is in reference to Paul, but also Joan. Again, in reference to Paul, and this is one of my favorite explanations for such phenomena, the astronomer W.K. Hartman writes in 2013 that the blinding light Paul saw was caused by a fireball from a meteor. Hearing God's voice would be understandable under such circumstances. We also have sunstroke for both Paul and Joan, but also Moses. That's 2007. The fact that Joan didn't menstruate as the cause of her voices, 1971. And of course, the bicameral mind, 1976. Some of these explanations in diagnosing visual and audio events are almost more outlandish than the theoretical possibility of a divine voice in the first place. What can we conclude about the two discourses I've been citing here, that of 15th century church and of early 19th century psychiatry? In some aspects, they're not so far apart as we might assume. Both interrogate the subject with an ideology that presupposes that they, and not the one interrogated, are the bearers of knowledge. The church, as the interpreter discerning between divine revelation and the workings of the devil on the one hand, and psychiatry of the 19th century, principally armed with scientific and this objective knowledge on the other. Both assume that they have a privileged position with respect to assessing the presence or absence of the truth and subsequently impose their findings on the subject. Thus, both assume that they understand and can interpret Joan of Arc's experience better than she can herself. Her own voice is ventriloquized, as it were, by both discourses, different though their teleologies may be. I mean, of course, psychiatry does not in principle execute patients, although it has done so. But the Church of the Inquisition also in principle doesn't execute. It relaxed the heretic to the civil authorities, asking them to show mercy, and knowing full well that burning at the stake would immediately follow upon the church's finding of heresy. The church eradicates Joan. Its metaphor, as for all heretics, is that she is a sick branch on the tree of Christianity, a branch that must be amputated in order for the tree to remain healthy. 19th century psychiatry does not amputate, obviously, nor does it judge in such black and white terms. But by way of nosology and scientific assumptions, it absorbs the subject's voice and capacity to interpret his or her own experience. J'arrive à la fin. The abnormality, as it were, of Joan's voices is thus domesticated in both disciplines. By execution in the first case, which is pretty serious domestication, and by a medico-nosological explanation grounded in the period's fervent belief in science in the other. In hermeneutically reading and then assessing the subject, both discourses reestablish their parameters of normalcy and place the abnormal firmly at the margins. Both rob Joan of her voices and rob her of her own voice as well. For unlike the possessed nuns of Loudun, for example, Joan's voice is spoke to and not for her. She retained the ability to say I and was never in doubt as to the differences between her mind and her body or the identities of the voices that spoke to her. Her interrogators, however, from both ideologies, do not acknowledge her position as subject within the strict confines of their respective discourses. Knowledge in both belongs not to Joan, but to her interrogators. So, j'ai plus de temps? Voilà. So let me just read my last paragraph. This is what I get for cutting Jim off yesterday. Certeau has argued that the role of quoted language is to accredit discourse. With its referential function, he adds, quoted language introduces into the text, quote, an affect of reality, and through its crumbling, it discreetly refers to a locus of authority. I'm talking about quoted text because we have, which I was going to talk about, the text of the trial, which is also Joan's voice, except that the trial was held in French, translated into Latin, translated back into French with summaries, scribes who, when they didn't know the Latin, would put in French terms, lost manuscripts, fragmented, and so forth. Thus, quoted voices, to return to the beginning of my talk, are the textual as against material, in the case of a phonic voice, embodiments of social ideology and experience. The voice of the 19th century psychiatry and the voice of the 15th century church are also there, whether spoken or written, and serve in turn to interpret the voice of the maid, as well as all the other voices. But her inner voices, her three saints, one archangel and two saints, for them, we continue to have only the ideologies of the religious and the medical for interpretation. In other words, Georges Bataille, when he's talking about a heresy trial of the same period, says these events happen. They actually happened. We have the stenography of them. The question here is to return to Bataille inversely, whether or not they did indeed happen, or how or why, these voices. So we'll have to await other discourses to domesticate the inexplicable. Thank you.
Nous allons, nous avons le temps pour des discussions et quelques questions. Moi, j'avais une petite question un peu précise, c'est sur Alexandre Bertrand, qui n'est pas un psychiatre, qui n'est pas un aliéniste. C'est un médecin magnétiseur. Je crois qu'il y a une différence parce que quand il parle d'extase, c'est un peu l'équivalent de transe,
hein, oui, qu'on appelle la transe. Oui, oui.
Et en fait, pour lui, l'extase, c'est aussi curatif puisque c'est un médecin magnétiseur. Mm-hmm. Donc il y a peut-être une nuance et je crois que c'est vraiment important de ne pas le voir comme...
Uniquement
comme un aliéniste. Il n'est pas uniquement, il n'est pas aliéniste. Il n'a pas, il n'est pas professionnellement aliéniste. C'est ça que je veux dire. Il est, en fait, il est polytechnicien. il est médecin. C'est le médecin de Maine de Biran. Et c'est un. Et il écrit également dans le Globe, qui est donc un journal républicain. Il écrit des articles de vulgarisation scientifique de la physique. C'est un physicien aussi.
Oui,
donc c'est pas du tout. Enfin, il n'est pas dans le même milieu que l'élu, tout
d'accord,
ça.
D'accord, mais enfin, d'un autre côté, il pose les mêmes questions.
Oui, il pose les mêmes
questions. Et c'est pour ça que je l'ai mis.
Non, mais ce que je voulais simplement dire, c'est que ce serait peut-être intéressant de nuancer, de voir un peu ce qu'il dit par rapport à extase. C'est pas tout à fait la même chose que hallucination. Et c'est un personnage très très intéressant,
oui, tout à fait. Bertrand. Mais il se plaint beaucoup de ce terme extase,
oui.
Mais
oui.
Il ne peut pas en trouver d'autres.
Absolument, absolument. Mais il est à la recherche d'un terme.
Oui, exactement.
Hein, et pas le terme, je pense, d'hallucination. Enfin,
oui, oui.
Et ce serait donc intéressant de le...
Oui, bien sûr. Non,
voilà,
merci.
C'est juste une petite
remarque
et une petite idée à donner. Voilà. Bon. Voilà, je me tais sur Alexandre Bertrand que nous sommes seuls à connaître, j'ai l'impression,
oui,
mais qui est un personnage tout à fait intéressant.
J'ai une question. Là.
Voilà, alors d'autres questions maintenant, je m'arrête. Oui.
Thank you, Françoise. You made some remarks about auricular confession along the way.
That made about what?
Auricular confession, I thought. What you're talking about, auricular?
No, auditory. Okay. I don't think I said auricular confession.
Auditory confession, right?
Oh, auditory.
I think it's the same. I think we're talking about the same thing.
Okay.
Do you see a difference there?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, we can talk about that.
Okay.
Whatever.
So this is about the framework, the specific framework of Catholicism here. Resistance to what will happen in the Reformation, the presence of the text to reading, the direct encounter through the Word. Think of Freud here, Andreas's Freud, through the encounter with the Word. In favor of sounds and images. In Ireland, those great towers were there to have images to teach the people during the time of Patrick. You were talking about Joan as a peasant who took the world in through the ear.
Well, through the eye, too, in that her church had the statue of St. Catherine, and she had other visual images that she could work on.
Okay. But in both cases, not through the, let's call it, the printed, the written word.
That's right.
Okay. So...
Except to the extent that it was read at Mass.
But then heard.
Then heard, exactly.
But only heard by her.
Yes.
Not read by her. That's what I'm
asking. That's exactly right.
Okay,
she was
so
illiterate.
I'm talking about the context of the coming Reformation. So within the play of non-literate visual signs and non-literate oral signs, how important is the context of the oral here? And is that something that one wants to think hard about in understanding what these voices mean for her story, at least vis-a-vis the first context of the church? I mean, we can, with Andreas, we can bring in the later context of 19th century psychology. But
I think it's absolutely fundamental, which is why I said that there were these wandering singers of tales who kept the tradition orally and who were heard all the time. They were like I said, it's like People magazine. You find out what all the movie stars are doing. The movie stars in this case are the saints. And she heard those. And that's why I said it's interesting that what she experiences is a repetition of some of these generic stories. But they were heard orally. They were sung. And she also knew prayers by heart because she couldn't read. But the oral is absolutely essential. And what's several of the alienists say that auditory hallucinations are much more interesting for them medically than visual ones. Visual ones are pretty commonplace, but auditory is much more interesting. And one of the alienists, I can't remember which one, says that hearing voices with both ears is, of course, very interesting, but hearing voices with only one ear is much more interesting. And that also, sometimes these voices can be heard from inside the body through the organs, and sometimes they come from outside. So Joan's came from the outside, but the oral is absolutely fundamental, and that's my point.
Just one more quick follow-up. So were the interrogating authorities aware of the connection between her early formation in oral tradition and her voices? Did they?
You mean the judges?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And this was an issue in the trial?
No. Well, or put it a different way, they used it against her. They asked very complicated theological questions based on written texts and analyses, knowing that she would not
commanded by the priest, but not by the people.
Exactly.
As far as I remember, she was asked in Rouen, not only, well, she was asked in which language do those voices approach you?
Yes, and she said
and
French.
And she said in French, and as far as I remember, she said, of course it was French because God was on the side of the French.
So that's right.
What was the problem, yeah? So one could say in terms of language history, that has two aspects to it. The one is the emancipation of the vernacular versus the Latin as the academic language, which then enters into a kind of nationalistic discourse on Jeanne d'Arc. And on the other hand, as you said, French was not her native tongue. So on the other hand, that would mean that French as a language, in the event later on then, imposed itself as the national language by suppressing the local dialects.
Yes, and
but
suppressing Langue, the whole of Southern
France. That might be
France.
A phenomenon of later,
no, you're absolutely
so to
right.
say, Jeanne d'Arc reception. My My question would be rather to let
and can I just interrupt a second?
Sure.
I had a whole section in this paper.
Oh,
which,
sorry. Yeah.
Because Jacqueline was looking at me very strictly. I didn't recite.
Non, mais c'était sur le français. Mais justement, mais à la même époque, au 19e siècle, la Vierge parle en patois
voilà.
À Bernadette. C'est assez intéressant.
Well, that's why it's interesting that the saints speak to her in French, because she didn't really know French very well. Anyway, I'm sorry, what were you going to add?
The question was whether there's a connection between the school of the alienist and the discourse of melancholia, because melancholia would be traditionally the discourse that would look for insane speak that is by itself kind of reasoned and is even a hallmark of a certain exceptional state or exceptional strand of people that have
Well, melancholia is problematic in the eyes of the church because it's one of the seven deadly sins.
Yeah. And,
acedia, right?
Normally we would link that to visual material, looking at Dürer or whatever, but maybe there's another discourse of melancholia that would be an aural discourse.
I don't know, Eustace, because, yeah. I mean, that may be true, I'd have to think about it, but in the case of Joan of Arc, yeah. The only time she gets melancholic is when she realizes they're going to kill her. And that her voices have stopped.
Yeah, my point was simply whether those alienists would simply take on the discourse of melancholia and modernize it by calling alienism what traditionally would be called a melancholic state.
I mean, it's a really interesting question, and there are early church fathers who write to depressed monks and try to talk them out of their depression. Mm-hmm. But in this case, the real question was, I mean, the two major questions is, I mean, Jacqueline knows much more about this than I do, but the two major questions in 19th century alienism is, A, how do you distinguish between reason and madness? And B, how do you explain, and that comes from A, that famous thinkers and figures saw and heard hallucinations? So thank you for your question, Eustace. I think Sarah has a question.
Well, thanks. That was really. I think it's the way you encase the whole talk in Althusser's ideology that I'm nervous about everything you're about to say because it's clearly part of this another ideology, and it's going to also.
But it always is, so it doesn't matter.
I know you can't help it, but I want to start with a quasi objective thing that I learned, and that's even worse. So I read this article somewhat recently, and I don't remember it that well because I was casually reading, that there is a recent study in psychiatry, the study where they were looking at schizophrenic patients who heard voices, and I think one particular man who heard one particular voice who was always telling him paranoid messages, and what they put in like a teeny tiny little microphone thing somewhere in like his throat section. And they discovered that he was, everything he heard the voices saying, he was saying.
Right.
Inside. In like super duper inaudibly.
Right. So he, which is Jane's point, right?
Yes, very Jane, yes, absolutely. But it combined with some of the thinking that also Jim was talking about, picking up on the orality question, reminded me of the sort of liminal presence that reading has in, you know, in some of the classical world, but, you know, moving on into the medieval world. I mean, so if you shift over to Augustine, who is much better at presenting himself to the world, much more successful, you know, and you look at his autobiography, which is, again, you know, he owns it, and it's his voice, and he presents himself.
Although he does hear a voice.
Well, right. That's the thing. He hears voices. Hearing voices is part of the deal, mm-hmm. right? And it just comes in different forms, right? So like hearing those kids playing outside, and interpreting the tololege as like this message, he presents that in a well packaged way that's non problematic, basically.
It's not problematic because he says it's a voice coming from the house next door.
Well, right. So but it's also a message.
Right, but it's a message.
And then there's that other moment, and I'm forgetting a key fact about it, but I think he goes into a church with his mother, and he sees a priest reading silently. And what I can't remember is if the priest is moving his lips or not, but in either case, he's surprised. He's never seen this before. And reading up until a certain point in different cultures is always an allowed and usually public or in some fashion. And so the activity when reading becomes a silent and internal thing is also a way of hearing voices. But you know,
but that comes much later, of course.
Yeah, but you can watch it with children. You can see them. I mean, I can see in my own nearly five-year-old that he began reading and always wants to read to other people. And now he doesn't always do that, but he's always sort of reading aloud to himself, right? So that there's a spectrum of hearing voices, which is always embodied and always speaking voices. And I just wondered if, I guess how much that you or anyone in the history of the people you're reading had considered how much like speaking there is in hearing in the case of Joan. Does that make sense?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure I can answer it. The voices are a big surprise to her, and she's 12 years old. I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't want to side with James and the bicameral mind, but it is a very convenient explanation. We can side with Freud and say that it's, you know, the superego asserting itself. But the only thing I can say is sort of what I said to Jim, which is that it's an oral culture. It's largely an illiterate culture. The only people who know how to read and write besides aristocrats are the clergy, and they use that against her in her trial constantly. And then there's these wandering minstrels who tell the stories of saints. So I don't think I'm answering your story except to say, I mean your question, your story. But what I'm trying to suggest here, in an Althusserian semi-fashion, I mean, I'm not an Althusserian, but is that these functions, as Prop calls them, that are in all the saints' stories, right, are recapitulated by Joan, and not coincidentally. And the importance of sound equally makes sense, given that she couldn't read.
It's still a way of reading.
So it is a way of reading, and but that's why it's interesting that Lateran IV Council removes from individuals the ability to read as in interpret their own experience. Yeah. They are the only readers who know. And as I said, that's one of the reasons that was one of the three final points proving heresy. So I don't know if I answered your question, but it's very interesting.
It's a factual question. If it's known historically, when did the voices fall silent? At what point in the process?
It's not clear, but it was during the trial. And she thought it was because they took her out, to make a long story short, and showed her where she was going to get burned, and she got scared. She was 19 years old. And then she recanted said, no, I was just kidding. None of this really happened. I never heard voices. I never saw anything. I never, you know, I just made it up. And then her voices stopped speaking to her pretty much right then, which is about 2 weeks before her death. And she says, she complains, she says, my voices are no longer speaking to me because I've betrayed them.
But up until then, even when the trial had started,
they were still there, yeah. I got...
Autre question?
Voilà.
Oui?
Okay. I'm just wondering if there's a tradition of female sanctity that she would be aware of through the minstrels or in some other way, and about sort of, it goes back to what Jim was starting on about not just auditory versus visible, but visible versus invisible because interior somehow or other.
But those are the stories that she would have heard from these traveling minstrels, and she was very aware of Catherine and Margaret's stories, which is why she chose them. Mm-hmm. And they were also warriors, which she obviously identified with.
I'm thinking also there's a tradition that probably was not familiar of female saints in the generation after Francis who had internal stigmata and which were discovered after they died, you know, through autopsy. I have no question at the end of that except that it seems kind of interesting that there's this other visual but internal tradition.
It's very interesting. I mean, what I try to suggest at the end here is that so far we have two discourses that explain all this stuff. One is the psychiatric discourse, the other is the religious discourse. The interesting thing for me about Joan of Arc is that there's a lot of stuff that happened that we have documentation for that is not obviously explicable. And for me, neither discourse is sufficient, or let's say neither works. So the question is, do we do, I mean, Sackville West ends her book by saying, I can understand this and I can understand this and this other thing, but there's this part that doesn't make any sense and it's like internal stigmata. I don't know what to do with it. And I'm sort of there, except I'm trying to say that it's sort of like when you read about Simone Weil, right? It's either the religious who talk about her Catholicism or it's the Marxists who talk about her political activity. And neither one somehow works with Simone Weil. And there's something going on with Joan that I don't understand and that I am saying perhaps, and I'm not resorting to either discipline. I'm saying we need a third way of looking at this stuff.
Une autre question?
Il y en a une là.
Ah, j'ai pas vu.
Yes.
Alors.
Pardon.
Vous êtes derrière, je vous vois pas.
I'll be quick. Just a very quick observation, actually, about one of these details. The wandering minstrels keep coming up. As far as I understand it, the troubadours and their ilk did not only hawk round religious songs. They were singing secular music as well.
Always. The troubadours, yes.
Yeah.
But the troubadours are from southern France.
Okay.
And we're talking about northeastern France.
Okay.
And we're talking about a different kind of singer of tales.
Okay, what they specialized only in Saint
Saens. In Saint Saens,
okay.
Which were right, considered then. The big deal.
Okay.
In that part of France. The troubadours in the south, whom I personally adore, were doing something different.
Yeah.
They were not doing Saint Saens.
Okay. All right, cool. I was going to say only about the crossing between the sacred and the secular,
right.
Since they're mostly singing either way about hearing things.
Right,
as a
right.
Distance.
Yeah, and the troubadour manuscripts include scores.
Yeah.
As you
yeah.
know. And are very interesting for that reason. But that's, as we used to say, a whole nother trip.
Yep.
Okay.
Je crois que là, on reste sur l'image des troubadours.
Voilà, thank you.
Et merci beaucoup.